these leaders are facing a very different landscape in a very different situation. I mean, there's a big forcing function that happens when you shift from a manufacturing-led economy and a consumption-led economy, which by definition requires a deeper thought around who are you serving and why? What is your value and your purpose? Why do you exist beyond just making money or growing really fast? These are really big questions that these leaders 100% recognize that they cannot continue to just keep doing what they've done.
Welcome to the IDOU Creative Confidence Podcast, a series focused on building your confidence at work to tackle your biggest creative challenges.
Join us as we learn insights and lessons straight from IDEO and today's most impact-oriented design thinking leaders.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard.
And I'm Kalita Stafford.
Hello, welcome to our Creative Confidence series. I'm Suzanne Gibbs Howard, and I'm here today with Charles Hayes. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you.
Charles is always one of my favorite people to connect with and have great conversations with. We're both very passionate about all of the change going on across Asia and especially in the very powerful and fast-changing nation of China. And so Charles came to IDEO. He'd done a lot of work in brand and design. He started off in our IDEO London office. And then around what year?
2008.
We were experiencing a lot of change in what was going on in the Chinese market. We'd started off at an office there, a studio that was very much about manufacturing and executing prototypes for some of our other offices. And we really started to see massive changes, as did the rest of the world, in this rising consumer economy, the rising middle class, and growing wealth in China, and really interesting demands for new services, new products, new experiences, and an entire change in the business culture. So Charles stepped into that office and has really helped us lead in very thoughtful ways some of the ways that we are working and collaborating in China and across Asia. So that's what we wanted to talk about today. So Charles, as a means to just dive into the conversation, we asked you to bring some of your favorite stories about people that you're working with who you think are quite representative of some of the shifts in leadership in China.
Sure.
So with that, we'll dive in and introduce you to some amazing characters.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. And thanks, Suzanne, for having me. There's a couple of stories that really came to mind in thinking about the changing landscape of leadership and of business in China. These stories are in no way a representative of all the diversity that's happening in the country right now. But I thought these are particularly some people that really inspire me in the work they're doing. Mm-hmm. One story that's very top of mind comes from the founder and chairwoman of a company called Arrow Fashion. Her name is Chen Ping. She has really been a groundbreaker in building a really successful fashion business in China for the domestic market. It's focused a lot on advanced manufacturing techniques for down and what down can do as an insulating fabric and also as a performance fabric. But what she's really facing is this constant need, as you can imagine, in an industry as dynamic and as tricky as fashion, is to constantly be understanding who it is that we're designing for, right? Who is, in her words, the muse that inspires us to create fashion that people not only want to wear, but that performs in the way that she wants it to perform. Yeah. And so I think she really represents one form of leader who has been tremendously successful in the past couple of decades doing what she's doing, and is now at a stage where China's economy is slowing, new technologies are being introduced, and she's really asking the question of how do I make sure that the next 20 years are as successful as the past 20? And so those are very important questions for her and really continuing to have her finger on the pulse of who her muse is.
Wow. Wow. Okay, so she's asking big questions about who she's designing for and how to keep up with the pace and keep her. How big is her company right now?
Well, she's got literally thousands of employees, and she's really at that stage where she has three or four very sophisticated manufacturing plants and factories around the country and nationwide coverage of her fashion brands, as well as a home line of comforters, duvets, et cetera. And so the big question of growth is going to come from her deeply understanding who she's designing for.
Okay, so that's Chen Ping. Okay,
yes.
So and who's another person that you wanted to share with us today?
Another person is Li Hongshu. He's the chairman of a very interesting company called Max Inf. And they are one of the largest producers of baby car seats. And so this has been an industry that's been around for a very long time, although more relatively new, I would say, in China, in that You know, there isn't this history of 30 or 40 years of really emphasizing car safety. I mean, cars are a little bit newer of a phenomenon there. And so he was really credited with one of the people trying to advance and champion child safety in cars when cars became, you know, the idea of owning a car became a very coveted thing. But he hasn't stopped there. And again, similar to Chen Ping, that growth that he has had and experienced in being able to provide car safety seats for the Chinese middle class is quickly shifting as he sees, you know, this shift in the automotive industry and this understanding that mobility goes far beyond the owned car or the driven car. He's asking questions about autonomy, autonomous vehicles. He's asking questions about different kinds of ways people move and use the city and how families can actually navigate that safely. So what does it look like to protect one's family in the context of moving through environments where car seats are no longer necessarily the predominant way of doing that?
Okay, right? So he's connecting his entire business to safety, security, how the entire mobility industry is changing and trying to keep up with the pace of that all at the same time.
Yeah.
All right. And so who's the third?
Yep, the third one is Sichuan Huang. So he is a really interesting and kind of a contrast to the first two. The first two have had quite successful businesses for a number of years, and they're really asking the question of what's next in terms of how to shift their business and continue to be relevant.
And he's quite a bit younger than the first
two.
He
is. Yeah. He's probably about 15, maybe even more years younger than the other two. And he represents, I think, kind of a breed of serial entrepreneur in China that in recent years has really risen into the spotlight. He's very focused on challenging the conventions and the norms around the integration and the seamless experiences that happen between digital and physical. He focused a lot on building media and gaming properties in China that literally challenge the whole notion of who's in control of what the experience is. There are physical players and competitors that compete against each other in the real world that are influenced, shaped, and controlled by online communities and vice versa. And so it's very interesting to see the ground he is breaking and almost really looking at this as a limitless world where he doesn't have an existing business that he's having to shift. He's creating entirely new paradigms for what it means to behave and interact and blurring the lines between the digital and the physical.
Okay, so you've got these three people. You've got somebody working in the forefront of fast-changing fashion, but in a point where China's changed already. Mm-hmm. And so we need to keep up that pace of change for the next two decades. You've got a second person who's working in a high-speed changing world of mobility where cars and the ways that we navigate, and there's been a rise of local consumption of individual cars, and then we're moving to automobility. Where does safety and security of your children fit in that world? And then somebody in the forefront of sports and gaming where virtual sports are becoming professional, where communities can participate. But I'm curious what you see that's common across such diverse leaders as these three.
One of the big things that's common across them, as you may be able to tell, even in the way I'm describing them, is this very strong realization that they need to be not only very bold and visionary about where they want to take their businesses, but their recognition that they absolutely do not have all the answers to these things, right? I mean, I think this is reflective of an evolution in Chinese business culture where you do have, historically something that has been considered very hierarchical, where you do have a chairman of a company who sits at the end of a long boardroom table and literally makes very definitive decisions about where the company will head and what the big ideas are that the company should follow. And in all the cases I just described, these people have more questions than they have answers. And they have a great deal of confidence and belief that if they're building the right teams, if they're looking at the right areas and getting inspired by a wider set of things going on in the world, that they will be able to lead in a very different way and help their companies grow in a very different way.
And so I know that's a theme that we talk about a lot here at IDEO and in the work that we both do, which is so focused on education and expanding the community that works in these ways, is the idea of leading through questions instead of leading through answers, that the pace of change in the world is so fast, that the challenges we're all facing are so complex that no single leader can answer things as may have been falsely expected even in the past. And so how do we tackle this? And so I know you teach a lot about some of the mindsets of leadership and using questions as a means to help people explore. And I wonder if you could talk
Yeah, I mean, one of the other things I didn't mention, but that all three of these people have in common, is actually they're all part of a program, a year-long program that we've been doing together with them. And it's called Lead a Creative China 2030. And it's with Tsinghua University, which is a formidable university in China, very influential and very talented in terms of the areas of research that they conduct. And so IDEO and Tsinghua University have gone on this journey of engaging a group of, you know, roughly 30 CEOs and chairmen of these kinds of companies who are asking really deep questions around not only from the perspective of leadership and how they need to show up and engage their business and the world, but also what are the roles that creativity and design and some of these big topics can play strategically in the growth of their business. And so in doing that, I think one of the other values they've recognized is that it can be quite scary to ask these big, bold questions on your own. And there has been tremendous value in bringing together leaders from different industries who share common challenges, even if the question they're trying to answer is in a very different kind of industry, solving a very different need.
Yeah, so you could be working on car seats, you could be working on internet gaming and online, offline blending.
Exactly.
And still the questions you're asking each other about the dynamics of the marketplace are similar.
Which is why I do believe that, you know, a cohort of leaders that are sharing these things together, that are helping each other through some of these things from a leadership perspective, is also quite powerful.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious some of the themes that you think are really particular to Chinese leadership. Like, what are some of the threads that you see them dealing with through this Lead a Creative China, as well as the rest of your work there?
Yeah, I mean, there definitely are some interesting themes that have come up. And I think we've explored all of those dimensions in creative leadership from, you know, the explorer and the gardener and the coach, and really particularly through the Tsinghua program, because it's such a unique opportunity for 30 executives to sit in a room together and talk about what they believe is working and not working, what they're seeing in their own futures, and to share those stories in quite an intimate way. And so I think there's a lot of power in that. And what we've seen in that program and in other environments are businesses that are trying very interesting ways to get people to really think differently, to even internally kind of in a friendly way compete, shall we say?
I think of, what's an example of one of these that you're really
I think of a rise in success that probably most people are aware of now, but of WeChat in China, that, you know, it has got a tremendous daily active user base. It's one of the, if not the predominant social platform. But that really started from a condition that was set by the chairman of Tencent to actually enable and give permission to multiple teams to start developing the same kinds of tools and features in parallel to each other and in a competitive context to see which ideas would actually win in market and predominate. And then at the end of that process, to consolidate those resources to build what then became WeChat. But at the beginning, there was not one single initiative called WeChat. There were many that were focused on trying to answer the same questions in different ways and then bringing those back together and saying, okay, now it's a moment to actually say we need to unite again. And so really, that's from a leadership perspective, those are very different stances, to give permission to multiple teams to do similar things and then at some point to be making decisions around how those come together to create real value.
So it's like kind of like an extended hackathon for the new vision for the company. You're just sort of asking this big, bold question, sending out multiple teams to go and tackle it and seeing which one has the most triumphant answer.
Correct.
And then bringing people back together. What if you're not the leader of the team? And can more junior people on teams in a Chinese business culture also lead through asking questions or being more provocative in their approach?
Yeah, I mean, most definitely. I think, you know, again, with all of these things comes a very large caveat that there isn't one China, and there's certainly not one kind of China company or one kind of Chinese leader. And so recognizing that it's an incredibly diverse landscape, depending on the conditions and and how a specific company's culture and structure is set up, I see a lot of space for people at various levels of an organization to have a voice. I think one of the interesting ways this has come out is in this conversation around what is called, often referred to as a wolf culture.
Yeah.
Huawei recently published a book about this culture and attributing a great deal of its success to being able to work in this way. A lot of the Chinese unicorns that have been fast growing in the tech space have also subscribed to this culture. And it's fundamental.
What defines a wolf culture?
Yeah, like, so I mean, basically it's this idea that you kind of operate as a pack, meaning you share the responsibility and take shared ownership of things, but it's also incredibly internally competitive. Mm-hmm. And so in that competition and in working incredibly hard and fiercely, you're not only pursuing the market to try to win, but you're also, you know, competing against each other. And at the same time, recognizing that you're part of a greater whole, right? And so some of the things that have come out of that have a lot of people have been to some degree critical of. I think work hours, this competition inside of a company can be a good thing. It can be a healthy thing. It can also be destructive.
What are some of the ways that they talk about, like, the amount of time that people actually spend working?
Yeah. Some of the things that really come out of this intense focus on work and fierce competitiveness is this idea of the 997 or the 996. And 997 or 996 simply mean 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. 6 days a week or 7 days a week. Yeah. And Lee Kai-fu very famously mentioned in a TED talk he gave recently of how some Chinese startups are actually using as a key selling point to attract young talent to their firm that they are a 996, not a 997 culture.
Wow.
And that's a selling point, that they don't work on Sunday.
But that's
right?
Also a way that we're seeing that these younger employees, because of the sheer volume of them and the desire for their skills, actually have a lot of influence in more contemporary ways in the Chinese workforce, just as they do in every workforce, many workforces around
the globe. That's right. And I would say the other thing around this idea of maybe teams and not necessarily only the boss or the most senior person being able to kind of call the shots or make decisions is that a lot of these businesses, certainly the internet giants, but other businesses as well, have from their beginning almost had an ecosystem or a platform mindset rather than a singular core competency. So you look at what Jack Ma's vision was around enabling small and medium enterprise and the growth of Alibaba. It's always had multiple components to it. It's always had connectivity in between the parts and the businesses he's building. Mm-hmm. And it's afforded the ability to build new businesses and more businesses and acquire quite a significant startup ecosystem. So you can imagine all of the young leaders in all of those places that actually on a day-to-day basis are given quite a bit of autonomy to make decisions around how they are going to contribute to that platform.
Yeah, fascinating. How did the mind shift happen from an absolutely hierarchical system where to one where younger people feel, or people lower than the boss in the hierarchy, feel that they have permission? What are ways that you're seeing this happen in Chinese companies or not?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. I think a really extreme example is the work that we've done and that we've also just observed in the market around state-owned enterprises in China. So they represent a very significant part of the economy. Even the leaders of China have been very critical in the past of those state enterprises not being the most efficient or the most competitive.
Yeah.
And that has come from, again, this era of very fast growth, where even in something like real estate, there was a literal land grab, literally the overbuilding of the environment just because you could. And now these leaders are facing a very different landscape in a very different situation. I mean, there's a big forcing function that happens when you shift from a manufacturing-led economy that is in some ways trying to catch up with certain rates of growth and scale that it has, and a consumption-led economy, which by definition requires a deeper thought around who are you serving and why? What is your value and your purpose? Why do you exist beyond just making money or growing really fast? How do we differentiate against both local competitors and foreign competitors? How are we going to attract a next generation of leaders that want to be at this company when there are so many young, dynamic startups that are popping up all over the country, where there are multinationals that are trying new things or maybe have very powerful, globally recognized brands? And so, you know, in categories like state-owned enterprises and maybe some of the more traditional industries, these are really big questions that these leaders 100% recognize that they cannot continue to just keep doing what they've done.
When we talk about the wolf culture and these high-speed, fast-paced, very competitive work environments, do you also see threads that counterbalance that, the role of purpose in a Chinese company and whether or not that has influence?
Yes, I think that's a great point. I think actually some of the things that we're seeing in the younger and this new generation of people that are coming into the workforce in China is a pretty significant shift, I think, from maybe 10 years ago. So, you know, going back 10 years, there was still a one-child policy. And what that actually, part of what that created was a tremendous amount of pressure on this person who, you know, had two parents and four grandparents, basically investing, saving quite a bit of their life savings to invest in supporting and developing this child and nurturing and caring for them. At some point, all of that nurture and care kind of flips and they become responsible for all of the care of these people, right? And so the pressure upon graduating from a top university and getting a good job and getting married and having one child and really continuing that legacy was incredibly strong. And so what was a really interesting shift to me maybe 5 years ago, and certainly the last couple of years, when the government kind of came out to announce that innovation and entrepreneurship would be the new twin engines of growth for the economy. Yeah. It legitimized the entrepreneur in a way that we had never seen before. Inherently in that legitimization is this notion of taking risk, of maybe your first job isn't in kind of a stable traditional company or a well-known brand that everyone respects or that your family knows about, but in trying something for yourself, challenging yourself, trying to break new ground and the courage that needs to come with that. And so all of that's really actually opened up, I think, a wider set of possibilities that the youth of China believe they have in terms of how to engage in and participate in the economy. And you've seen this with the proliferation of co-working spaces and a very vibrant venturing community and a lot of the investment that follows from that. And so that's, I think, shifted a lot of mindsets and created a really interesting, diverse set of ideas and notions around what it means to work. I think the other thing that's happening also is, you know, I live in Shanghai, a city of 24 million people. It also used to be that, you know, eastern coast of China and Beijing, Shenzhen, Shanghai used to be the places everyone wanted to migrate to. And I think there is a rising sentiment that, you know, some of the things that make these cities great also present very direct challenges to them, the constraint of a dense urban population. And so some people are talking about the attractiveness of a tier two city, where maybe the air quality is a bit better, where maybe the pace of life's a bit slower, where maybe they can be closer to their family. And so that's a shift also that we're seeing that introduces a different dynamic to how we think about growing communities of talent.
We see Chinese business. Historically, people have thought of it as a heavy duty copycat culture, the whole Shenzhen thing, the whole like copying and kind of adapting. But I feel like you're seeing some threads that are pushing that to a new degree that's far more than just cut and paste one company from one part of the world into a Chinese context.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are a couple layers to that. I mean, in the early days, the Shenzhen, you know, term, as you rightly mentioned, was a term meaning copycat, right? So taking something that was invented or designed somewhere else and then being able to maybe produce it at scale or replicate it quite closely. But I think what we've seen is that there is an actual form of innovation that takes place in that copying. And that copying isn't a direct copy. It's not a blind copy of not thinking about why or what you're copying. It's actually I think this is true anywhere in the world. I don't think this is unique to China. This idea that you're looking out into the world for things that are great ideas, things that are working in other places, and asking what can we learn from that and bring into our environment, our local culture, satisfy local needs, and then rigorously adapt it. And the things that are special about China in that context are speed and scale. Mm-hmm. And so you could take something that maybe on the surface feels like it was taken as an idea from somewhere else, but it uniquely and very quickly turns into something of its own. You could compare kind of WhatsApp to WeChat, and you could maybe when WhatsApp and WeChat first started, they might have had similar functionality, but the power of the platform of WeChat goes far beyond communications, far beyond any of the things that anyone could have dreamed of, and certainly that WhatsApp today is capable of doing. And so that, I think, has been a really interesting evolution. And not to mention now we're getting the reverse Shanghai, which is there are a lot of people starting to copy things that are native to China or grown in China. I was really interested in reading about Amazon Prime Day.
Yeah.
That is now becoming a thing. And this, you know,
it a copy of the Singles Day?
You know,
right?
Singles Day, I started in the early 2000s and this idea of people going online, buying things for themselves through e-commerce and it turning into, you know, a $20-30 billion kind of sales day in 24 hours.
Anti-Valentine's Day. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
But so those, so, but what I think that's all healthy. I think that those, that's the whole way that we learn is not just by believing that, you know, this not invented here syndrome is actually not necessarily the most critical, you know, the inventing by oneself is not necessarily the only way to innovate and really create real value for people. Yeah.
Political power holders have a lot of influence, certainly in China, more so than in many other nations. But also one of the interesting things you were sharing with me the other day is that so many of the big businesses are family owned.
Yeah.
And so talk a little bit about some of the dynamics you see there when you're working and collaborating with influential leaders in China.
Yeah, that's a really interesting topic that I think extends beyond China into the rest of Asia as well. Family-owned businesses or family-run businesses, there's a significant number of them. I think they're in their, they are a category that are going through their own transformation as well. You have typically a lot of, again, I would say kind of traditional industry businesses. And in those traditional industry businesses, these executives have been very successful and they've been able to do things like send their children abroad for education and really create a level of kind of prosperity for their families that maybe others have not had access to. And what that's created is a real question, I think, in a lot of second generation business owners who it's very popular, I think, now for a lot of Chinese nationals to be educated in the West in this category of family-run businesses to come back. And then they're faced with this kind of perplexing paradox of, do I want to run that business? And if I do, I know it needs to fundamentally be different. Or I'm actually not interested in that. I'm more excited by all of the new things that are happening over here, or over there. And so what do you do with that? And so there's this both this fear and excitement of what's going to happen to all of these really actually great businesses that have been built.
Mm-hmm.
Who's going to run them? How do you shift maybe in many cases to kind of a professional management team that is recruited from the outside that's based on, you know, CEO and management level qualities? Or do you stick with kind of the family structure to do that? Mm-hmm. And I think it's unique in each case, but it's a really interesting question.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your experience with Hunter Gatherer as an interesting company. I know they're one of the amazing, super impressive pairs of innovators that we've profiled in some of our work at IDOU. And just talk a little bit about how they are helping to change the shape of business
in
China.
I think that's a great example of a brother and a sister who, you know, are Chinese, but were raised in the U.S. and really at some point consciously made a decision to come back to China and tackle some of the things that they were very passionate about tackling, that they were seeing in the family industry, which was food, and very much wanting to, they were very inspired by some of the things happening in the West and asking the question of, you know, how might some of these things be applied in China, or is the China context something completely new and fresh that we can innovate from? And they've done a bit of both. And so Hunter Gather really came out of a passion for them wanting to not only reconnect on a personal level to where they're from, but actually tackle a systemic challenge in the process, leveraging the family knowledge around food supply chains and some of the very exciting technology that's happening. And so they're moving into some really interesting food tech spaces now that I think are going to really help to transform the way food is thought of in China.
Yeah. And I think they have like a successful farm to table restaurant chain moving through China and making some really bold moves and asking bold questions and kind of pulling a new family business.
Exactly.
So,
that's right.
Last question for you today is about your own leadership practice and how living in China for the last decade has shaped you as a leader. What's one thing that you're working on right now?
The idea of not having all the answers could not be more core to, to me thinking of the kind of leader I should be, need to be, and am to some degree. When I moved to China 10 years ago, I didn't speak the language. I wasn't familiar with the culture in a deep way. And I certainly wasn't aware of most of the businesses in China and what they were doing and the trajectories they were on.
Yeah.
And so I had nothing but questions when I moved there.
Yeah.
And what I've loved about China is I continue to have 90% questions. And I have a couple of answers every once in a while. But what I found is those constantly change. And so for me, this has done nothing but really push me into a permanent state of curiosity that is incredibly inspiring to me. It can be overwhelming, but I love that. And I'd much rather have it that way and really be trying to kind of influence, inspire, and do the things that we as IDEO are trying to do in a market like that, but at the same time being incredibly open to having my entire worldview change every 20 minutes.
I think
more people in the world need to do that. I think it would, you know, because there are ideas that are coming from all over the place, and the more we share them, the better off we'll be.
Awesome. I think we'll leave it there with encouraging everyone to go for it with a mindset of curiosity and asking questions and admitting that none of us know all the answers. So thank you, Charles, for joining us today, and we'll see you next time soon on the Creative Confidence Series.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Creative Confidence from IDEO-U. Stay up to date on our Creative Confidence conversations and send your questions for our upcoming guests. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, and sign up for our IDEO-U newsletter at IDEOU.com/CC. Thanks for joining us.